Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Centers for Disease Control reports that since 1999, suicide rates have increased by nearly 30% nationally and in Ohio by 36%. The report was issued in the day between the suicide deaths of chef-turned-TV host Anthony Bourdain and fashion designer Kate Spade. Today we're going to talk about not just the rising suicide rate, but also how to talk about suicide, how to respond to it, and how to respond if you suspect it's a threat. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-8255. The website is suicidepreventionlifeline.org. We'll put that and state numbers for you on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Joining us is Ohio Suicide Prevention Foundation Board President Sandy Williams. Welcome to the show, Sandy.
Thank you.
Also, the Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Ohio, Terry Russell. Welcome back, Terry.
Thank you, Ann.
And joining us is Clinical Psychologist and Behavioral Health and Suicide Prevention Coordinator for the Center for Suicide Prevention and Research at Nationwide Children's Hospital, Dr. John Ackerman. Welcome back.
Thank you, Ann.
The conversation about suicide is key, but we need to first talk about how we talk about it. That's really been something in recent days and weeks after some high profile suicides in which the media, you know, which the media naturally would report on. Sandy Williams, why does how we talk about suicide matter?
Let me start by saying that I am what is known as a survivor. I lost my father to suicide 7 years ago, and I admit that before that, I didn't know anything about it, and I didn't know how to have the conversations. What I learned was that when someone is talking about suicide, they're really thinking about it. I think there was always an old wives' tale that if they talk about it, they won't do it. At least that's what we thought with my dad, and that unfortunately turned out not to be true. So I think it's critical that we talk about it in a way that removes the stigma of talking about it, so that people feel that if they're having those feelings, it's okay to tell people and it's okay to get help. I know one of the big things for me, and people will think this is small, but it's not. Using the word commit with suicide just makes the hair on the back of my neck go up.
It's sort of like a rite of passage type of thing.
You know, and commit is a crime. I mean, when I look at it, it's like what you do is you commit a crime. I mean, there can be good ways to commit, but for the most part, when you're talking about suicide, you're doing it. It was like an illegal act, and that just adds to the stigma of it, that it was something wrong. Or when somebody talks about it and they say, gee, I know that depression, which many people who die by suicide suffer from, you know, depression is an illness. And then they'll add the little but. Yeah, I understand depression is an illness like arthritis or like heart disease, but no but. So two small words,
commit and everything.
But, it diminishes it. Yeah. So it's important that we're upfront and we talk about it and that we make it safe for people who are suffering or even for those of us who have lost someone to talk about it.
There is on the same coin, I don't know if it's on the same side of the coin or on the other side, but that question of normalizing. If we talk about it too much, are we normalizing it? Dr. Ackerman?
Yeah, I think that sometimes we've confused media a little bit in terms of whether we should be talking about suicide or not, because we know that if we increase coverage so much that it sort of saturates what people are hearing and that we're normalizing it as a behavior that's a typical response to a stressor, then that might actually increase the likelihood that others who are vulnerable engage in suicide behavior. But what we want to help individuals know is we can talk about suicide responsibly. We need to talk about suicide responsibly in order to shape the conversation, in order to send messages of hope and help other people understand that the majority of people who attempt suicide can go on to live normal, healthy lives, and that we can find ways to bridge that gap between crisis and moving on to a way of living that involves routine coping, safety, planning, and lots of support around the community and building those connections. So I think we want to be able to send the message that media should talk about this, but if it's done in specific ways with language, like Sandy talked about, that it can be incredibly helpful. And there's actually a lot of research backing up that talking about it in responsible ways reduces the potential for suicidal behavior in those who are exposed instead of increasing it when it's done in a really unhelpful or unsafe way.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about suicide today. You just heard from Dr. John Ackerman. He's a clinical psychologist and behavioral health and suicide prevention coordinator for the Center for Suicide Prevention and Research at Nationwide Children's Hospital. Also, Sandy Williams, Ohio Suicide Prevention Foundation Board President, and with us as well, Terry Russell, Executive Director of NAMI Ohio. Terry, are you talking about it more among your clients, among your the population of people that you work with at NAMI?
Absolutely. You know, we're kind of angry that the system has not addressed this issue. We had 187 people die in Franklin County this year of suicide, one every 5 hours in the state of Ohio. It's time to scream and say, this is an illness. It's no different than any other illness, and the brain happens to be the most complicated organ of the body. And when a person has a depression and needs help, let's give them the help they need. The fact is, we don't have that help available. So let's stop it and let's get services. Last time I was here talking to you, it was about violence, the kids in schools, and the need to do something in the schools. We need to have a mental health professional in every school in this state for early identification, people that somebody can go to and say, I'm feeling these things, and then get them help. Right now, that has not been done, and it just should be.
When we're talking about how we talk about it, does it matter? I mean, are there some people that are more influenced by the conversation than others? Dr. Ackerman?
The research that exists, which is not, you know, as comprehensive as we would want it to be, suggests that there are individuals who seem to be at higher risk. We know that young people, for example, teenagers tend to be more susceptible to some of the harmful messaging that can go on. We know that individuals who are already vulnerable to suicidal thoughts and behaviors, or maybe have experienced their own traumas, can experience really difficult reactions when they hear news that they can identify with. So part of this is how identifiable the individual who dies by suicide is. For example, if you look at the Robin Williams coverage, men, especially men of his demographic, and were more likely to lose their lives to suicide after that coverage, using the same method, which is another thing that we're trying specifically to encourage,
to stop the descriptions of how the suicide was done.
Absolutely.
Why is that a problem?
It's a problem for a few reasons. One, unlike any other, most forms of death, we don't, you know, kind of drill into the morbid curiosity of and kind of as a friend of mine says, a rubberneck about this illness. It also, one of the things that we're worried about is it breaks down some of the barriers that lead a person to remain living. And so there's a theory that an individual who acquires the capability of suicide is more likely to make an attempt on their life. So we fortunately, most of us have a life-preserving instinct. And if you start to see blueprints in front of you, if you start to see other people who are struggling immensely with distressing thoughts and ambivalent about whether life is worth continuing or not, you get into a situation where if you've seen others do it, especially high-profile celebrities or those you can identify with, and if you are thinking that, wow, this is something that they chose to deal with their pain, maybe it makes sense for me. These are the things that we get really worried about.
Another thing with the celebrities, and right away I heard it from people, and they used the word but. You know, they must have been very depressed, but they had so much to live for. Sandy?
Yeah, exactly. And I think, feeding off what Dr. Ackerman just said, I think that can depress people even more. They think, wow, there's Kate Spade, right?
Yeah.
And look, and she had everything, and I have nothing. And this is, you know, this is the way she chose to deal with this. So this is the path I'll go down. So many people that are dealing with suicidal ideation feel that they're worthless, feel that they're such a burden. And they can't see through that. And I think that's what's frustrating, again, you know, depending on the way this is reported on, when you just say, oh, Kate Spade suffered from depression, but you don't know what else that means. I don't know that somebody can relate their pain to that pain. And so again, I think we need to talk about it. I think it's helpful to talk about it so that people understand they're not alone, but how we do it and how we respect it is so important.
Laura in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Laura.
Hi.
Laura, could I interrupt you just briefly and ask you to pull your mouth away from your phone?
It's, thank you.
Laura, it's really bad, the static.
Can you hear it now?
Yeah, I'm going to have somebody, why don't you call back and hopefully it'll be better.
Wait a minute, give me one more chip. Is this all right?
No, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Please call back. Yep. Please call back. Okay. Sorry about that, Laura. We encourage people to call us, though, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I'm very sorry about having to let Laura go. Hopefully she can call us right back and we can get her on the line. Photographs in the wake of a suicide of a grieving family, those are discouraged as well. Terry Russell, why does that matter in the newspaper if we see a grieving family member?
I'm not a clinician.
I know,
so I'm
but
not real sure.
But you work with family members.
I work with families every day.
Right.
And I've been with so many who say to me, we didn't see anything. We had no idea that this was going to happen. Then about 2 or 3 months later, they come back and say to me, we did see things. Now that we have time to look and see what's going on. So I think we also must tell everybody listening to this show that not all the bad behaviors or bad things happening to people cause this someone to die of suicide. Many people have bad things going on and live productive lives. What we have to understand is when these bad things are happening, there are symptoms, there are signs, and that somebody has to be there to hold their hand, to listen. And if it gets so severe, get help. That's what's missing. So I think the pictures or the rhetoric that you read all the time certainly plays a role. But I don't think that's the issue. The issue is that there is so much communication out there. And we live in a pretty tough world. And when people are bombarded with all of this, the brain then is hijacked. And people make the wrong decisions. And so let's start communicating. Let's start talking. Let's start recognizing that this is an illness like any other. And the other thing is, it's treatable. We have prevented suicide.
Why this uptick, then? It is treatable. We know, Dr. Ackerman, that it's treatable. We have medications. We have talk therapy. We have all kinds of things like that. Why did it get worse?
I know in the context of the recent Center for Disease Control report, they're indicating that we've got a 25% to 30% increase in suicides over the past 17, 18 years. Mm-hmm. And we've been seeing that for a while, and it's been pretty consistent. So the uptick is a long increase. I think what we're seeing is increases in disconnection between people and communities. I think we're seeing changes in the way people respond to distress. I think we're seeing a lack of investment, to be quite honest, in suicide prevention and mental health differences. I think, as another colleague said, you get what you pay for with suicide prevention.
I know there's a big cut in mental health funding in the Trump administration budget,
which is disturbing because there wasn't enough in suicide prevention. There's an article in the New York Times yesterday that indicated we actually invest more in dietary supplement research than we do.
At the CDC.
In suicide prevention, which is just cracked $50 million recently. And you've got billions in other forms of illness, and we lose 45,000 people per year.
If we were losing that many to anything else.
Suicide is the second leading cause of death for children 14 to 30. Think about that. Second. And we're not addressing the issue.
And it's the 10th leading cause of death in the country, period.
Period.
So can you imagine something like breast cancer or heart illnesses and as high as they are on that list if we were saying, oh, we're just not going to invest in understanding this or treating this.
Because, but.
But. Right, yeah. Exactly.
We're going to continue our conversation. We welcome calls, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about suicide today, how to talk about suicide, and what to do if you suspect somebody is in danger of taking their life. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A new report from the Centers for Disease Control found a nearly 30% increase in the national suicide rate since 1999, with a 36% increase in Ohio. Suicide is increasingly viewed as a public health as well as a mental health crisis. We're talking about what can be done. Still with us, Ohio Suicide Prevention Foundation Board President Sandy Williams, Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Ohio, Terry Russell, and Clinical Psychologist and Suicide Prevention Coordinator for the Center for Suicide Prevention and Research at Nationwide Children's Hospital, Dr. John Ackerman. The National Suicide Prevention Hotline is 1-800-273-8255. The website is suicidepreventionlifeline.org, and we'll have those numbers and state and local numbers posted on our website at wosu.org/allsides as well. We talk about funding for research and prevention, suicide prevention. It's about, you said it just cracked $50 million, Dr. Ackerman. Tell us about what kind of research you do at Nationwide Children's and how what you do differs from maybe a typical clinical setting.
Yeah, I think the novel thing about our Center for Suicide Prevention Research is that we can combine our research institute leadership, and the director of that program is Dr. Jeff Bridge, who does some really innovative work in understanding risk factors for suicide among youth, both in terms of how they think, the choices they make, the environments they live in, and we can be able to use that information very rapidly as we provide information to the community, and we work with schools to help them deliver suicide prevention programs. So we are able to take what they're learning about what puts a young person at risk and translating that into actual opportunities to intervene on the ground. What we should be doing, for example, to screen individuals who may be at risk, because I think it was really both Sandy and Terry have touched on it. We are putting the burden on young people in distress or adults who are in distress to be able to come to us, to be able to navigate a fragmented healthcare system, and to be able to find their way through all of these barriers.
But part of the disease is the inability to do that.
Absolutely. The burden, the shame, yeah. The difficulties thinking that you deserve help in the first place. And then we're putting all of this expectation on individuals to go through and navigate that. So what we really want to do is begin to have a conversation that makes people feel okay about that, and then to actually proactively screen, whether it be in schools, your primary care office, being able to connect with families like NAMI does so well, really make sure that people can be open about this, and that will then allow others to get support immediately, and then have best practices in place to follow up when you do identify it. So you can't just identify, you need to then have a series of steps to get the person support and then have them their own coping safety net in place after that.
Everyone can play a role in suicide prevention. It can't be programs as we talk. Mm-hmm. By learning the warning signs and being there, being to children, one of the things that really concerned me is the elderly, the tremendous increase in the elderly dying by suicide. We can do better. And the way to do it is your listeners learn about suicide. And if anybody you see has some of the symptoms, talk to them. It's okay. It's not going to hurt anything. And get them help if you can.
So it's okay to say, it sounds to me like you're talking about hurting yourself. taking your life. You could say that to somebody, Sandy?
Absolutely. And I think people, again, are fearful that if they say that, that's going to put that thought in their mind.
Yeah.
Furthest thing from it, it's likely already in their mind. I think one of the good things that has come out of this past week is a lot of folks who are suffering from depression have come out and said, it's really fabulous that you're all putting out the suicide hotline number. I don't have it within me to call that number. I need folks to help me. So as Dr. Ackerman and Terry just said, the best thing all of us can do is there's even a program called Be the One. It's really simple. It's ask, are you thinking of harming yourself? Keep that person safe. Be there for them. Help them connect with help and follow up. It's really easy for the rest of us. So, yeah, you can't be afraid that you're going to offend somebody to say, are you thinking of hurting yourself? Do you have a plan? Do you have the means? That's, you know, kind of the other thing we all have to be aware of. If you find out somebody is having those kinds of thoughts, look and see, do they have ready access to firearms or medications that they could then use to harm themselves?
Are those hotlines just for people contemplating, or could it be for other people trying to figure out how to help somebody?
Yeah, those folks, I know on the Franklin County line, for example, they do take those kinds of calls to say, this is what I'm dealing with. How can you help me navigate that situation? Absolutely, there are people there to help you with that.
Yeah, I would just add to what we say about directly asking to individuals. Mm-hmm. So we've screened over 23,000 kids by asking very direct questions. Have you thought about ending your life? Do you ever think about killing yourself? And these are questions that we know from research. Madeline Gold out of Columbia, for example, has done some really great research to show you don't increase the stress levels of individuals who are asked the question, are you thinking about suicide? And you actually, from both our clinical experience and what we do in the schools, we know that a person who's been struggling with suicidal thoughts, if you ask them very clearly and directly, if they've been thinking about killing themselves, it removes an incredible amount of burden. And then they know that by asking, you want to have that conversation and they have someone they can finally talk to. And it's really powerful for the individuals who finally have the opportunity to share this and move on to the next step instead of hiding this burden that they've been keeping. They can actually get to the point of receiving help.
Michael in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Michael.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have two questions, and this is this conversation is making me think of other topics on other days that you've had. And one, I heard a story on NPR that there is a nonprofit in India, for example, that under a licensed therapist, they kind of train people that are not licensed under them through a 6 or 8 week course to specifically get over the cultural barriers of seeking help. In India, for example, that's a problem. And I know your guests have been talking about not enough resources, and I know there's lots of regulation here in America, but is there any sort of thing that we can take from that of kind of making satellite therapists to reach out to communities that...
To lay people.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Lay people helping lay people. People mm-hmm. in the community that they trust. And number two, my question, and this is a bright red flag in my head of this conversation, and Anne, correct me if I'm wrong, there's certain rules and protocols of what the media can share about high-profile suicides, like names and pictures, like that's not allowed.
Right. Well, you name them, but you, as far as rules and protocols, they're within organizations. There isn't like a law. But, yeah, good organizations have rules and protocols in place.
Well, okay. So this analogy is blaring in my head.
Okay.
With all of the, you know, good organizations have rules and protocols, and you should reach out if you're thinking of harming yourself or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
How are all of these things also not applied to kids or anyone else who wants to, for example, do a mass shooting? Of I want to hurt others and then myself. Why do we sensationalize it on the news? And then why don't we also reach out to those people? This seems completely hand in hand. I know it's not the topic for today, but it seems so analogous.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. It's certainly things that people talk about. Does that resonate with you, Dr. Ackerman?
Yes, I appreciate the caller bringing up that there are national guidelines both for journalists through their ethical code and through specific organizations. There's www.reportingonsuicide.org and
Poynter Institute has a great.
And we've worked on some guidelines to update the Ohio suicide reporting guidelines. So we have some of that. But into your other question about mass shootings, there are actually guidelines for mass shootings as well that you could look up. And they have similar – there are some similarities there. There are definitely the idea that you're promoting certain behaviors unintentionally by putting a lot of attention on it is clearly something we want to be concerned about, and providing methods and guidelines and blueprints.
And then we're always looking for that balance between providing information about a huge news event that affects lots of people.
It's not about censorship. It's about promoting responsible reporting in a way that lets people know what tools they can bring to bear in a situation.
Avoiding trigger words. How do you over-dramatize a mess? Murder, it's really hard to do that. All you have to do is just say what happened, but it's done. I mean, and of course there's television. I mean, that's a huge piece of all of this. Michael, thanks for that call. And likewise, David in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, David.
Hello. My father took his own life a couple years back, and that sent me into quite the spiral of learning how to cope with all those feelings and also just how to move on. And after a lot of therapy and self-searching, I've largely, you know, moved on, and I'm happy, and I can comfortably think about the situation without too much pain. And I do appreciate and approve of all the increased activity of media and news outlets trying to make this hotline aware and become more of a normalized subject instead of such a stigmatized one. However, I think with the increase in percentage of folks actually doing this or dying this way, I think some media, specifically like television, movies, things like that, they're trying to incorporate this. And my point is that I can't get through a night of television where some sitcom doesn't have some, you know, character who's deeply affected by a suicide or a suicide attempt. And it gets to the point where it's like, I just don't want to have to think about my dead father every time I turn on the TV to get away from the hard things. And I imagine people that haven't had the chance to get as much therapy and help as I have probably just go into a spiral. And I wonder if that sort of oversaturation isn't hurting some folks that are dealing with it at the expense of just trying to make it a more normalized topic.
Sandy Williams. Yeah.
First of all, I'm so sorry for your loss. I obviously understand that pain, and I feel your pain. I understand what you're talking about. My husband and I are big fans of British murder mysteries, and there can't be one without a suicide in it, or at least the theory. And you're right. It sends you reeling. My friends, I have good friends, and they keep checking on me this past week because they know that it does. You know, when I heard about Kate Spade, I have a lot of Kate Spade products, so there, you know, you just, you know, it's somebody that you know, identify
to.
With that way. You're like, what, you know, what? And Anthony Bourdain, I know he had a daughter. And so all I've been able to think about for the last few days is that little girl without her dad, because I know how that feels. So it's a delicate balance. Absolutely. And that's why I think if done in the right way, we can actually help each other by educating other people about suicide. I mean, I don't know about you, but and people don't mean to do this, but people will be around me and they'll like, oh my God, if I have to listen to this guy one more time, just shoot me. You know, those sorts of things. And I just get really taken aback, and they don't know what they've just done to me. Right. But, and I know people don't do that on purpose, but there's just a lot of those kind of colloquialisms in our language that, because I think we haven't talked about this subject. So I agree with you that it needs to be done in a sensitive way to take care of all of us who have been through it. But on the other hand, I know I'm like you. I spent time trying to figure this out. I'm a lawyer by training. So the first thing I did was just start reading. I'm like, what just happened here? I can't make sense of this. And, what I've turned around to do is I do suicide prevention work. But that for me is a way to say, okay, I can't save my dad, but maybe I can save somebody else. So I think that we need to we need to go out and educate people and have the conversations, but absolutely do it in a way that recognizes there are real people involved in this. Mm. And I think that's why, especially with the media and when they report on these things, when I was watching some coverage of Kate Spade, I actually saw them roll the body out of the building, and I was aghast. Mm-hmm. And again, all I could think of was, this woman had a daughter. She had a family. What are you doing? None of us have the right to see that. So, but again, it needs to be a balance. I think there's value in us discussing that somebody who we all perceived as having this fabulous life still couldn't get out of that depression. So how can we help other folks?
David, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
Yeah, take care. We are going to continue our conversation. We're talking about suicide. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out our Facebook page and post a question or a comment there. With us, you just heard from Sandy Williams. She's the Ohio Suicide Prevention Foundation Board President. Also with us, Dr. John Ackerman, a coordinator for the Center for Suicide Prevention and Research at Nationwide Children's, and Terry Russell, the Executive Director of NAMI Ohio. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A new report by the Centers for Disease Control found a nearly 30% increase nationally in the rate of suicide since 1999. The increase occurred across demographics and among people with and without mental health conditions or known mental health conditions. Access to quality mental health care always is a factor. Still with us, Ohio Suicide Prevention Foundation Board President Sandy Williams, Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Ohio, Terry Russell, and clinical psychologist and suicide prevention coordinator for the Center for Suicide Prevention and Research at Nationwide Children's, Dr. John Ackerman. Listeners, if you or someone you know is in crisis, if you want to help somebody, you can call the National Suicide Prevention Hotline at 1-800-273-8255. The website is suicidepreventionlifeline.org, and we'll have that and local numbers, state and local numbers, that you can call on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Terry Russell, you brought up a good point when we went off the air last time, and that is suicide prevention does help. We're talking about rates now, and there's been an uptick. We've also gone through a bad recession. There's lots of things. It's very complicated, but you want to say there's hope.
Yeah. Sometimes when we talk about these issues, it's depressing in itself. And those out there and your listeners who are depressed or who have these thoughts, just understand that treatment works, that if you do go and get help, that 80% of people with depression can live productive lives and fun lives, and that we should celebrate that. And the prevention, there's just not enough of it.
But know it works.
We know it works, and we just ask everybody to listen to say, you know, suicide is a forever decision, and we need to change that. We need to have people recognize that, that in a certain period of time in one's life, all of us have had those times of depression or challenges. And I just ask that everybody think, okay, I'm going to get through this, and I need to have someone help me. And that person can be anybody, your last caller. It can be people out on the street who can learn the symptoms and be someone to talk to. And usually that will have a major impact.
And I want to follow up on what Terry said, and actually one of the other callers who talked about what other people can do. At the Ohio Suicide Prevention Foundation, we offer online interactive trainings that anybody can take that really does help you to recognize the warning signs. It's even interactive to the point lets you practice how to have those tough conversations. So, you know, I would encourage anybody, again, they're free, they're available to anyone. You can go to ohiospf.org under resources and find those. They're called gatekeeper trainings.
And I would say that although clearly from the report, we need to do more than just treat the problem away, what we do know and what Terry brought up in a really helpful way is that treatment does work. And what we're finding is that it's not just general treatment. For suicide, you actually have very specific suicide treatments, including cognitive behavioral therapies for suicide prevention, crisis interventions that work, a program called the Collaborative Assessment and Management of Suicidality, which the Ohio Suicide Prevention Foundation has supported and subsidized heavily to make sure that our clinicians and our workforce know how to use treatments that work for suicide and not just treating the underlying problems, because most people have thought if you treat depression, if you treat anxiety, the suicidality will go away. And actually, research is showing you specifically should be treating suicidal behaviors and the drivers that underline a person's suicidality, and do things like means safety, safety planning, and ensuring that a person is engaging in meaningful parts of their life, not just preventing the crisis. We actually have to give people reasons for wanting to continue to move forward and have hope. And I also don't think we focus on that enough. We have to have lives worth living and really promote connection and support among people to make sure that those moments of crisis don't, you know, simply return and be navigated only to return again. We need to do more to make sure we've got a comprehensive plan in place.
Toby in Delaware, you're on the air. Hi, Toby.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. Anne, you've mentioned a lot about normalization. And my concern is, what if somebody is considering this and we're not talking about it anywhere else, they're going to go online. And they're going to find out about it there. And they're going to normalize themselves through that means. And there's not going to be any of the other side of, there's not going to be any of the positive side of the discussion. It's only going to be, mostly it's going to be the negative, and it's going to be, oh, do it, you know, the, you know, they're going to end up in those dark places.
They'll find other people like themselves.
Yeah, so they end up in a little community of themselves rather than finding that little, the light at the end of the tunnel. They're not finding that.
Okay.
All right.
And that's one of our symptoms is the information out there today for especially young people is all over the place. And somehow, again, those adults who see these signs have to intervene. And it's not bad to intervene. It's good to intervene. They must intervene and have the skills to do that. And the way to do that is what Sandy said, is go get the research. There's enough research out there. The problem is the lack of communication between adults and children.
Susan in Marysville, you're on the air. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I'm calling with two quick things. One is quick. One is I'm appalled to see a suicide used as a plot device to solve problems in movies and novels. And the other is more personal. I lost a son to suicide several years ago. I was living in another town, and people knew me there, so they knew about him. But when I moved, I don't know how many children to tell them I have. You know, I don't want to, you know, because it's stigmatized, too. If I had lost him to an accident or cancer, you know, it's okay. But suicide is stigmatized. So I don't know how many children I have or how to deal with this. And, you know, I don't want that to be the first thing they know about me. But after, you know, after they know me for a while, it's like, well, why didn't you tell, you know. And so anyway, it's just, you know, it's just a problem. But also, I'm appalled when it's used as a plot device to solve problems. And I see this in movies all the time. It's just a cheap trick. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, if you could comment, I'd appreciate it.
Susan, thanks for calling.
Yeah, Susan, I am so sorry for your loss. And I understand completely. I remember right after my father died. And, you know, there was actually discussion. Do we tell people how he died? And we actually have started a family charity, and we do a suicide prevention walk in Belmont County. And again, my mother was the driver of that. She really wanted to do it. But when it came to, okay, I'm going to start doing TV interviews and we have to go out there and say what really happened, she's paused for a moment for that very reason. It's a small town. A lot of people didn't know how he died. They just know that he died. So I understand completely where you're coming from. And again, I'm hoping that through this work, not only do we save lives, but we do work with folks like us who have had this loss and make it okay. I'm not ashamed of the way my father died. He died as the result of a disease. He suffered from depression and anxiety. He fought the good fight. He didn't win. I need to talk about that, though, and I'm willing to talk about that and use him in that way, if I can say, just to say to other people, this happened, but we can get through it and we can find answers on the other side.
Go ahead, Doctor.
I'm also really sorry for your loss, Susan, and appreciate you sharing that idea about the plot device. And I think that goes back to the other piece we were talking about, whether it's a picture, whether it's a sensationalized headline. What we're removing is the humanity of the person who died by doing these things. And I think both in terms of our journalism, but I think even more so, we're missing that piece in terms of training for other sort of more mass, more popular media, whether it be television shows or that the other caller, David, was talking about too, that just exposed to it. And it's not really done in a sensitive way. So having other people hear from survivors of suicide loss or suicide attempts and learning what that really means to be able to do that well and to tell a story that's meaningful and not as a plot device is really important.
Susan, thanks again. Take care. Anne in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Anne.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Yes, my daughter has been suicidal for decades. And just yesterday we had a conversation, and those celebrity suicides in her mind, she says, well, my situation is so much worse. They had all of these resources, and yet they couldn't live with it. That justifies my being able to commit suicide. Do you hear what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's one thing. The other thing is that the mental health system, she cannot get the help she needs. Even though she has gone to counseling, the counseling is often not available. Often it does not focus on the needs. And she's been to situations where they are trying to give her the correct medication for depression. But it has never worked. So she's no longer taking any medication. Mm. So I guess what I'm asking is, what can I do to help her to find the help that she needs so that she can survive?
Dr. Eckerman?
I mean, first of all, your story is probably not uncommon, where people are working really, really hard to find the types of solutions and coping strategies and sometimes medications that that allow them to deal with this chronic depression. And I think sending a message that simplifies things and saying, oh, if you just, you know, this medicine will do the trick, or this specific therapy. I think sometimes we need to help people understand the spectrum of mental health differences, and that sometimes involves treatment for a mental health condition that can be addressed in a short-term course of therapy or finding that right medication right away. But a lot of times it is a real battle, a chronic illness, if you will, that requires lots of persistent self-care from the people who are trying to help these individuals, and really making sure that you're consulting and knowing that there are others who may be struggling with the same experiences, and build that network of connection, and being persistent in a healthcare system that doesn't always meet the needs of individuals, trying to find the specific treatments that may work, and realizing we're not there yet with where we need to be. We need to invest in both treatments and other strategies to get there.
Terry Russell.
Yeah, I would urge that you get involved. And by the way, thank you for staying by your daughter. So many times who we deal with every day, the families just are beat down so much they quit being advocates. And so you calling today and being an advocate for your daughter, God bless you. The other thing is, please get involved with your local NAMI chapter here in Franklin County. They do great work. You can get training from them, go through their family-to-family program, which will put you with other people going through exactly the same thing. This is a lonely illness. It's not a casserole illness. Someone told me the other day that when you go to a hospital, you don't have people there all the time because of the stigma. So get involved with NAMI Franklin County and see if you can get support for yourself. And that ultimately will also give you other avenues other families have gone through.
Is there a quick number, Terry?
You can call area code 614-224-2700. That's my office, NAMI, Ohio, okay. And they can certainly tap you into Franklin County.
Okay. Carissa, you're on the air. Hi, Carissa.
Hi. I just wanted to talk a little bit about my own experience with it. I know a lot of what I've gone through in the last year, I really didn't even know existed. I've been receiving treatment for mental health for probably 10 years now, close to 10 years. And I'm 22, and about 2 years ago, I really was in crisis and didn't really know it. And when I went to visit my psychiatrist, she brought up doing a partial hospitalization program, which it was 30 hours a week or so. And so I went and I did a partial hospitalization program and then intensive outpatient program, where I learned a ton of really helpful skills to help get me out of crisis. And then from there, I learned that I had an eating disorder and ended up getting partial hospitalization treatment and intensive outpatient treatment for my eating disorder. And I didn't even know I was suicidal, but I was having intrusive images and I was seeing myself dead. And even though I didn't want that, it was really becoming significant in my life and intrusive. And now, or since the PHP IOP for my eating disorder, then I was identified with a trauma history. And so I've been meeting now with a trauma clinician every week, and I do a once weekly dialectical behavioral therapy skills group. And I'm about to move into a comprehensive DBT modality of treatment. And I think it's just important to know that there are a lot of options, and I've been engaging in a lot of CBT for a long time, and really finding the trauma component and finding like the DBT has been really helpful. And to wrap it all up, I want to say thank you to Dr. Ackerman, because I saw you while I was at Children's Hospital for a few years, not at Children's Hospital, but when I got treatment at Children's Hospital for a few years. So I want to say thank you.
Oh, thank you for sharing, Carissa.
Thanks, Carissa.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Bye.
I'll just say I really thank Carissa for sharing her story. I certainly didn't know she was going to call in, but really appreciate her bravery of sharing what has worked for her. And I think it's so powerful when people with this lived experience are able to let other people know. I mean, I have so much credibility whether it be a treatment provider or so-called suicide prevention expert. It's really the people with the voices who connect with other people who are going to make a difference in this and in the biggest way possible. And the more we can spread that message, it's so important.
You know, and I couldn't necessarily follow the alphabet soup, but I appreciated that she was laying out that it's complicated.
Yep.
It's multifaceted, but there is a process, and that she's working through it. It just as you would if you had cancer,
right,
or any other kind of disease. And it's okay to talk about all these different pieces of the puzzle. And Carissa, thank you so much for calling in. We really appreciate it. We're just about out of time. I thank all of you as well for joining us today. Sandy Williams, board president for the Ohio Suicide Prevention Foundation, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
And Terry Russell, executive director of NAMI Ohio, thanks to you as always.
Thank you. Always love to come in.
And Dr. John Ackerman, a clinical psychologist and also suicide prevention coordinator for the Center for Suicide Prevention and Research at Nationwide Children's Hospital. Thanks to you as well.
Thanks for being such an advocate, Ann.
Listeners, once again, if you or someone you know is in crisis, the National Suicide Prevention Hotline, 1-800-273-8255. The website is suicidepreventionlifeline.org. We'll have links to all of the organizations we've also talked about today. So check out WOSU.org/allsides. Get the information, educate yourself, and help others. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.